not above a little charity now and again.
Thank you, sir, I said meekly. It's much appreciated.
I could sense the crowd's disappointment as I rolled over like a dog for Ambrose's money.
Don't mention it, Ambrose said smugly. Always a pleasure to help out the needy.
In vintage coin, that'll be 2 nobles, 6 bits, 2 pennies and 4 shims.
I can do my own conversion, he snapped. I've travelled the world with my father's retinue since I was a boy. I know how money spends.
Of course you do. I ducked my head.
Silly of me.
I looked up curiously. You've been to Modegg, then?
Of course, he said absent-mindedly as he proceeded to dig through his purse, pulling out an assortment of coins. I've actually been to High Court in Kershin. Twice.
Is it true that the Modegan nobility regard haggling as a contemptible activity for those of any high-born station? I asked innocently. I heard that they consider it a sure sign that the person is either possessed of low blood or fallen on truly desperate times. Ambrose looked up at me, frozen halfway through the act of digging coins out of his purse. His eyes narrowed.
Because if that's true, it's terribly kind of you to come down to my level just for the fun of a little bargain.
I grinned at him.
We Rue love to dicker.
There was a murmur of laughter from the crowd around us. It had grown to several dozen people at this point.
That's not it at all,
Ambrose said. My face became a mask of concern.
Oh, I'm sorry, my lord. I had no idea you'd come on hard times.
I took several steps toward him, holding out my admissions tile.
Here, you can have it for just a halfpenny. I'm not above a little charity myself.
I stood directly in front of him, holding out the tile.
Please. I insist. It's always a pleasure to help the needy.
Ambrose glared furiously.
Keep it and choke,
he hissed at me in a low voice.
And remember this when you're eating beans and washing in the river. I'll still be here the day you leave with nothing but your hands in your pockets.
He turned and left, the very picture of affronted dignity. There was a smattering of applause from the surrounding crowd. I took flourishing bows in all directions.
How would you score that one?
Will asked Sim.
2 for Ambrose, 3 for Quoth.
Sim looked at me.
Not your best work, really.
I didn't get much sleep last night, I admitted.
Every time you do this, it makes the eventual payback that much worse,
Will said.
We can't do anything but snap at each other, I said. The Masters made sure of that. Anything too extreme would get us expelled for conduct unbecoming a member of the Arcanum. Why do you think I haven't made his life a hell?
You're lazy, Will suggested.
Laziness is one of my best characteristics, I said easily. If I weren't lazy, I might go through the work of translating Edamate Tas and grow terribly offended when I discover it means the Edema Drip.
I raised my hand again, thumb and middle finger extended.
Instead, I'll assume it translates directly into the name of the disease, Nemseria, thus preventing any unnecessary strain on our friendship.
I eventually sold my slot to a desperate Raylar from the fishery named Jaxim. I drove a hard bargain, trading him my slot for 6 jots and a favour to be named later. Admissions went about as well as could be expected, considering I couldn't study. Heme was still carrying his grudge. Lauren was cool. Elodine had his head down on the table and seemed to be asleep. My tuition was a full 6 talents, which put me in an interesting situation. The long road to Imre was mostly deserted. The sun brushed through the trees and the wind carried just a hint of the cool that fall would soon be bringing. I headed to the Aeolian first to retrieve my loot. Stanchion had insisted that I leave it there last night, lest I break it on my long, inebriated walk home. As I approached the Aeolian, I saw Diok lounging against the doorpost, walking a coin across the back knuckles of his hand. He smiled when he saw me.
Oh, there. Thought you and your friends would end up in the river by the way you were weaving when you left last night.
We were swaying in different directions, I explained, so it balanced out.
Diok laughed.
We've got your lady inside.
I fought down a flush and wondered how he had known I was hoping to find Denner here.
I don't know if I would call her my lady, exactly.
Sovoy was my friend, after all. He shrugged.
Whatever you call her, Stanchion's got her behind the bar. I'd go grab her before he gets overly familiar and starts practicing his fingering.
I felt a flash of rage and barely managed to swallow a mouthful of hot words. My loot, he was talking about my loot. I ducked inside quickly, guessing the less Diok saw of my expression, the better it would be. I wandered through the three levels of the Aeolian, but Denner was nowhere to be found. I did run into Count Threep, though, who enthusiastically invited me to have a seat.
I don't suppose I might persuade you to pay me a visit at my house sometime,
Threep asked bashfully.
I'm thinking of having a little dinner, and I know a few people who would love to meet you,
he winked.
Word about your performance is already getting around.
I felt a twinge of anxiety, but I knew rubbing elbows with the nobility was something of a necessary evil. I'd be honored to, my lord, Threep grimaced.
Does it have to be, my lord?
Diplomacy is a large part of being a trooper, and a large portion of diplomacy is adherence to title and rank. Etiquette, my lord, I said regretfully.
Piss on etiquette,
Threep said petulantly.
Etiquette is a set of rules people use so they can be rude to each other in public. I was born Dene, first, Threep second, and Count last fall.
He looked imploringly up at me.
Den for short?
I hesitated.
Here, at least, he pleaded. It makes me feel like a weed in a flowerbed when someone starts lording me here.
I relaxed. If it makes you happy, Den. He flushed as if I'd flattered him.
Tell me a bit about yourself, then. Where are you lodging?
On the other side of the river, I said evasively. The bunks in Mews were not exactly glamorous. When Threep gave me a puzzled look, I continued. I attend the university?
University?
He asked, clearly puzzled.
Are they teaching music now?
I almost laughed at the thought. No, no, I'm in the Arcanum. I immediately regretted my words. He leaned back in his seat and gave me an uncomfortable look.
You're a warlock?
Oh, no, I said dismissively. I'm just studying. You know, grammar, mathematics. I picked two of the more innocent fields of study I could think of, and he seemed to relax a bit.
I guess I just thought that you were...
He trailed off and shook himself.
Why are you studying there?
The question caught me off guard.
I've always wanted to. There's so much to learn.
But you don't need any of that. I mean,
he groped for words,
the way you play. Surely your patron is encouraging you to focus on your music.
I don't have a patron, then, I said with a shy smile. Not that I'm opposed to the idea, mind you. His reaction was not what I expected.
Damn my blackened luck.
He slapped his hand on the table hard.
I assumed someone was being coy, keeping you a secret.
He thumped the table with his fist.
Damn, damn, damn.
He recovered his composure a little and looked up at me.
I'm sorry. It's just that...
He made a frustrated gesture and sighed.
Oh, have you ever heard the saying, one wife, you're happy, two, and you're tired?
I nodded.
Three and they'll hate each other.
Four and they'll hate you,
Threep finished.
Well, the same thing is doubly true for patrons and their musicians. I just picked up my third, a struggling flautist.
He sighed and shook his head.
They bicker like cats in a bag, worried they're not getting enough attention. If only I'd known you were coming along, I would have waited.
You flatter me, Den.
I'm kicking myself is what I'm doing.
He sighed and looked guilty.
That's not fair. Saffron's good at what he does. They're all good musicians and overprotective of me, just like real wives.
He gave me an apologetic look.
If I try to bring you in, there'll be hell to pay. I've already had to lie about that little gift I gave you last night.
So I'm your mistress, then? I grinned. Threep chuckled.
Let's not carry the analogy too far. I'll be your matchmaker instead. I'll help you toward a proper patron. I know everyone with blood or money for 50 miles, so it shouldn't be that hard.
That would be a great help, I said earnestly. The social circles on this side of the river are a mystery to me. A thought occurred to me. Speaking of which, I met a young lady last night and didn't find out much about her. If you're familiar with the town... I trailed off, hopefully. He gave me a knowing look.
Ah, I see.
No, 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 I protested. She's the girl that sang along with me, my Halloween. I was just hoping to find her to pay my respects. Threep looked as if he didn't believe me, but wasn't going to make an issue of it.
Fair enough. What's her name?
Deanne. Threep seemed to be waiting for more. That's all I know. Threep snorted.
What does she look like? Sing it if you have to.
I felt the beginning of a flush on my cheeks. She had dark hair to about here. I gestured a little lower than my shoulder with one hand. Young, fair skin. Threep watched me expectantly.
Pretty? I see.
Threep mused, rubbing his lips.
Did she have her talent pipes?
I don't know, maybe.
Does she live in the city?
I shrugged my ignorance again, feeling more and more foolish. Threep laughed.
Ho-ho-ho! You're going to have to give me more than that.
He looked over my shoulder.
Wait, Nesdiok, if anyone could spot a girl for you, it'd be him.
He raised his hand.
Diok!
It's really not that important, I said hurriedly. Threep ignored me and waved the broad-shouldered man over to our table. Diok strolled over and leaned against the table.
What can I do for you?
Our young singer needs a little information about a lady that he met last night.
Can't say I'm surprised. There were quite a crop of lovelies out. One or two asked about you.
He winked at me.
Who caught your eye?
It's not like that, I protested. She was the one who sang my harmony last night. She had a lovely voice, and I was hoping to find her so we could do a little singing.
I think I know the tune you're talking about.
He gave me a broad, knowing smile. I felt myself blushing furiously and began to protest again.
Oh, settle down. I'll keep this one between my tongue and teeth. I'll even keep from telling Stanchion, which is as good as telling the whole town. He gossips like a schoolgirl when he's had a cup.
He looked at me expectantly. She was slender, with deep, coffee-coloured eyes, I said before I thought about how it sounded. I hurried on before either Threep or Diok could make a joke. Her name was Deanne.
Ah,
Diok nodded slowly to himself, his smile going a little wry.
I guess I should have known.
Does she live here?
Threep asked.
I don't believe I know her.
You'd remember,
Diok said.
But no, I don't think she lives in town. I see her, off and on. She travels, always here and gone again.
He rubbed the back of his head and gave me a worried smile.
I don't know where you might be able to find her. Careful, boy. That one will steal your heart. Men fall for her like wheat before a sickle blade.
I shrugged as if such things couldn't be further from my mind, and was glad when Threep turned the topic to a piece of gossip about one of the local councilmen. I chuckled at their bickering until my drink was done, then made my farewells and took my leave of them. Half an hour later, I stood on the stairway outside Devi's door, trying to ignore the rancid smell of the butcher's shop below. I counted my money for the third time and thought about my options. I could pay off my entire debt and still afford my tuition, but it would leave me penniless. I had other debts to settle as well, and as much as I wanted to be out from under Devi's thumb, I didn't relish starting the semester without a bit of coin in my pocket. The door opened suddenly, startling me. Devi's face peered out suspiciously through a narrow crack, then brightened with a smile when she recognized me.
"What are you lurking for?" she asked. "Gentlemen knock, as a rule."
She opened the door wide to let me in. "Just weighing my options,"
I said as she bolted the door behind me. Her room was much the same as before, save that today it smelled of cinnamon, not lavender. I hope I won't be inconveniencing you if I only pay the interest this term.
Not at all, she said graciously. I like to think of it as an investment on my part.
She gestured me toward a chair.
Besides, it means I get to see you again. You'd be surprised how few visitors I get.
It's probably your location more than your company, I said. She wrinkled her nose.
I know. I settled here at first because it was cheap. Now I feel obliged to stay because my customers know to find me here.
I laid 2 talents on the desk and slid them toward her.
Do you mind a question?
She gave me a look of impish excitement.
Is it inappropriate?
A bit, I admitted.
Has anyone ever tried to report you?
Well now, she sat forward in her chair. That can be taken a number of different ways. She raised an eyebrow over one icy blue eye.
Are you being threatening or curious?
Curious, I said quickly.
I tell you what.
She nodded at my lute.
Play me a song, and I'll tell you the truth.
I smiled and unlatched the case, drawing out my lute.
What would you like to hear?
She thought for a minute.
Can you play Leave the Town Tinker?
I played it, quick and easy. She came in enthusiastically on the chorus, and at the end she smiled and clapped like a young girl. Which, in hindsight, I guess she was. Back then she was an older woman, experienced and self-sure. I, on the other hand, was not quite 16.
Once, she answered, as I put my lute away. 2 years ago, a young gentleman, Elliot, decided it would be better to inform the constable than to settle his debt.
I looked up at her.
And? And that was it.
She shrugged carelessly.
They came, asked me questions, searched the place. Didn't find anything incriminating, of course.
Of course.
The next day, the young gentleman admitted the truth to the constable. He had made the whole story up because I had spurned his romantic advances.
She grinned.
The constable was not amused, and the gentleman was fined for slanderous action against a lady of the town.
I couldn't help but smile.
I can't say, as I'm terribly...
I trailed off, noticing something for the first time. I pointed at her bookshelf.
Is that Malkaff's The Basis of All Matter?
Oh, yes, she said proudly. It's new, a partial repayment. She gestured towards the shelf.
Feel free.
I walked over and pulled it out.
If I'd had this to study from, I wouldn't have missed one of the questions during admissions today. I'd think you'd have your fill of books at the archives, she said, her voice thick with envy.
I shook my head.
I was banned, I said. I've spent about 2 hours total in the archives, and half of that was getting thrown out on my ear.
Devi nodded slowly.
I'd heard. But you never know which rumours are true. We're in something of the same boat, then. I'd say you're slightly better off, I said, looking over her shelves. You've got Teckham here, and the Horrorica.
I scanned all the titles, looking for anything that might have information about the Amir or the Chandrian, but nothing looked especially promising.
You've got The Mating Habits of the Common Dracus, too. I was partway through reading that when I was kicked out. That's the latest edition, she said proudly. There's new engravings, and a section on the Fainwat.
I ran my fingers down the book's spine, then stepped back.
It's a nice collection. Well, she said teasingly, if you promise to keep your hands clean, you could come over and do some reading now and again. If you bring your lute and play for me, I might even let you borrow a book or two, so long as you bring them back in a timely fashion.
She gave me a winsome smile.
We exiles should stick together.
I spent the long walk back to the university, wondering if Devi was being flirtatious or friendly. At the end of the 3 miles, I hadn't reached anything resembling a decision. I mention this to make something clear. I was clever, a burgeoning hero, with an Allah like a bar of Ramsden steel. But first and foremost, I was a 15-year-old boy.
when it came to women, I was lost as a lamb in the woods. I found Kilvin in his office, etching runes into a hemisphere of glass for another hanging lamp. I knocked softly on the open door. He glanced up at me.
"Aller Quoth, you're looking better."
It took me a moment to remember that he was speaking of 3 span ago when he banned me from my work at the fishery due to Willem's meddling. "Thank you, sir, I feel better." He cocked his head minutely. I lowered one hand to my purse. "I would like to resolve my debt to you." Kilvin grunted.
"You owe me nothing."
He looked back down at the table and the project in his hands. "My debt to the shop, then," I pressed. "I've been taking advantage of your good nature for some time now. How much do I owe for the materials I've used during my studies with Manet?" Kilvin continued to work.
"1 talent, 7 jorts, and 3.
The exactness of the number startled me, as he hadn't checked the ledger in the storeroom. I boggled to think of everything the bear-like man was carrying around in his head. I took the appropriate amount from my purse and set the coins on a relatively clutter-free corner of the table. Kilvin looked at them.
"Aller Quoth, I trust you came to this money honorably."
His tone was so serious I had to smile.
"I earned it playing in Imre last night."
"Music across the river pays us well."
I held my smile and shrugged nonchalantly. "I don't know if I'll do this well every night. This was only my first time after all." Kilvin made a sound somewhere between a snort and a huff and turned his eyes back to his work.
"Ilksa Dahl's pridefulness is rubbing off on you."
He drew a careful line on the glass.
"Am I correct in assuming that you will no longer be spending evenings in my employ?"
Shocked, it took me a moment to catch my breath.
I came here to speak with you about...
About coming back to work in the shop. The thought of not working for Kilvin hadn't crossed my mind.
"Apparently your music has more profit than working here."
Kilvin gave the coins on the table a significant look.
"But I want to work here," I said wretchedly.
Kilvin's face broke into a great white smile.
"Good. I would not have wanted to lose you to the other side of the river. Music is a fine thing, but metal lasts."
He struck the table with 2 huge fingers to emphasize his point. Then he made a shooing motion with the hand that held his unfinished lamp.
"Go! Do not be late for work, or I will keep you polishing bottles and grinding ore for another term."
As I left, I thought about what Kilvin had said. It was the first thing he had said to me that I did not agree with wholeheartedly. Metal rusts, I thought. Music lasts forever. Time will eventually prove one of us right. After I left the fishery, I headed straight to the Horse and Four, arguably the best inn this side of the river. The innkeeper was a bald, portly fellow named Caverin. I showed him my talent pipes and bargained for a pleasant 15 minutes. The end result was that in exchange for playing 3 evenings a span, I received free room and board. The Four's kitchens were remarkable, and my room was actually a small suite, bedroom, dressing room, and sitting room, a huge step up from my narrow bunk in the mews. But best of all, I would earn 2 silver talents every month, an almost ridiculous sum of money to someone who had been poor for as long as I had. And that was in addition to whatever gifts or tips the wealthy customers might give me. Playing here, working in the fishery, and with a wealthy patron on the horizon, I'd no longer be forced to live like a pauper. I'd be able to buy things I desperately needed, another suit of clothes, some decent pens and paper, new shoes. If you have never been desperately poor, I doubt you can understand the relief I felt. For months, I'd been waiting for the other shoe to drop, knowing that any small catastrophe could ruin me. But now I no longer had to live every day worrying about my next term's tuition or the interest on Devi's loan. I was no longer in danger of being forced out of the university.
I had a lovely dinner of venison steak with a leaf salad and a bowl of delicately spiced tomato soup. There were fresh peaches and plums and white bread with sweet cream butter. Though I didn't even ask for it, I was served several glasses of an excellent dark vintage wine. Then I retired to my rooms, where I slept like a dead man, lost in the vastness of my new feather bed. Chapter 61 Jackass, Jackass. With admissions behind me, I had no responsibilities until fall term began. I spent the intervening days catching up on my sleep, working in Kilvin's shop, and enjoying my new luxurious accommodations at the Horse and Four. I also spent a considerable amount of time on the road to Imre, usually under the excuse of visiting Threep, or enjoying the camaraderie of the other musicians at the Aeolian. But the truth behind the stories was that I was hoping to find Denna. But my diligence gained me nothing. She seemed to have vanished from the town completely. I asked a few people who I could trust not to make gossip of it, but none of them knew more than Deok. I briefly entertained the thought of asking Sovoy about her, but discarded it as a bad idea. After my sixth fruitless trip to Imre, I decided to abandon my search. After my ninth, I convinced myself it was a waste of valuable time. After my 14th trip, I came to the deep realization that I wouldn't find her. She was well and truly gone. Again. It was during one of my Denna-less trips to the Aeolian that I received some troubling news from Count Threep. Apparently, Ambrose, first-born son of the wealthy and influential Baron Jackis, had been busy as a bee in the social circles of Imre. He had spread rumours, made threats, and generally turned the nobility against me. While he couldn't keep me from gaining the respect of my fellow musicians, apparently he could keep me from gaining a wealthy patron. It was my first glimpse of the trouble Ambrose could make for a person like me. Threep was apologetic and morose, while I seethed with irritation. Together we proceeded to drink an unwise amount of wine and grouse about Ambrose Jackis. Eventually Threep was called up onto the stage, where he sang a scathing little ditty of his own design, satirizing one of Tarbeen's councilmen. It was met with great laughter and applause. From there it was a short step for us to begin composing a song about Ambrose. Threep was an inveterate gossip monger with a knack for tasteless innuendo, and I have always had a gift for a catchy tune. It took us under an hour to compose our masterwork, which we lovingly titled Jackass, Jackass. On the surface, it was a ribald little tune about a donkey who wanted to be an arcanist. Our extraordinarily clever pun on Ambrose's surname was as close as we came to mentioning him, but anyone with half a wit could tell who the shoe was meant to fit. It was late when Threep and I took to the stage, and we weren't the only ones worse for drink. There was thunderous laughter and applause from the majority of the audience who called for an encore. We gave it to them again, and everyone came in singing on the chorus. The key to the song's success was its simplicity. You could whistle or hum it. Anyone with three fingers could play it, and if you had one ear and a bucket, you could carry the tune. It was catchy and vulgar and mean-spirited. It spread through the university like a fire in a field. I tugged open the outer doors of the archives and stepped into the entry hall, my eyes adjusting to the red tint of the sympathy lamps. The air was dry and cool, rich with the smell of dust, leather, and old ink. I took a breath the way a starving man might outside a bakery. Willem was tending the desk. I knew he'd be working. Ambrose wasn't anywhere in the building. I'm just here to talk with Master Lauren, I said quickly. Will relaxed.
He's with someone right now. It might be a while.
A tall, lean, Kildish man opened the door behind the entry desk. Unlike most Kildish men, he was clean-shaven,
and wore his hair long, pulled back into a tail. He wore well-mended hunter's leathers, a faded travelling cloak, and high boots, all dusty from the road. As he shut the door behind him, his hand went unconsciously to the hilt of his sword to keep it from striking the wall or the desk.
"Titalia te kiuri e danasieth,"
he said in Siaru, clapping Willem on the shoulder as he walked out from behind the desk.
"Furlan tua tetam."
Will gave a rare smile, shrugging.
"Oin satva, tua kvarein."
The man laughed, and as he stepped around the desk, I saw he wore a long knife in addition to his sword. I'd never seen anyone armed at the university. Here in the archives, he looked as out of place as a sheep in the king's court, but his manner was relaxed, confident, as if he couldn't feel more at home. He stopped walking when he saw me standing there. He cocked his head to the side a little.
"Kaitsien!"
I didn't recognize the language.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Oh, sorry,"
he said, speaking perfect Aturan.
"You look Tillish. The red hair fooled me."
He looked at me closer.
"But you're not, are you? You're one of the Ru."
He stepped forward and held out his hand to me.
"One family."
I shook it without thinking. His hand was solid as a rock, and his dark, keeldish complexion was tanned even darker than usual, highlighting a few pale scars that ran over his knuckles and up his arms.
"One family,"
I echoed, too surprised to say anything else.
"Folk from the family are a rare thing here,"
he said easily, walking past me towards the outer door.
"I'd stop and share news, but I've got to make it to Eves down before sunset or I'll miss my ship."
He opened the outer door and sunlight flooded the room.
"I'll catch you up when I'm back in these parts,"
he said, and with a wave he was gone. I turned to Willem.
"Who was that?"
"One of Lauren's Gellers,"
Will said.
"The Ari."
"He's a Scriv," I said incredulously, thinking of the pale, quiet students who worked in the archives, sorting, scribing, and fetching books. Will shook his head.
"He works in acquisitions. They bring back books from all over the world. They're a different breed entirely."
"I gathered that," I said, glancing at the door.
"He's the one Lauren was talking to, so you can go in now,"
Will said, getting to his feet and opening the door behind the massive wooden desk.
"Down at the end of the hall, there's a brass plate on his door. I'd walk you back, but we're short-staffed. I can't leave the desk."
I nodded and began to walk down the hallway. I smiled to hear Will softly humming the melody from Jackass, Jackass under his breath. Then the door gave a muffled thump behind me, and the hall was quiet, save for the sound of my own breathing. By the time I reached the appropriate door, my hands were clammy with sweat. I knocked.
"Enter,"
Lauren called from inside. His voice was like a sheet of smooth grey slate without the barest hint of inflection or emotion. I opened the door. Lauren sat behind a huge semicircular desk. Shelves lined the walls from floor to ceiling. The room was so full of books there wasn't more than a palm's breadth of wall visible in the entire room. Lauren looked at me coolly. Even sitting down, he was still nearly as tall as me.
"Good morning."
"I know I'm banned from the archives, Master," I said quickly. "I hope that I'm not violating that by coming to see you."
"Not if you are here to good purpose."
"I've come into some money," I said, pulling out my purse, "and I was hoping to buy back my copy of Rhetoric and Logic."
Lauren nodded and came to his feet. Tall, clean-shaven, and wearing his dark master's robes, he reminded me of the enigmatic, silent doctor character present in many Madigan plays. I fought off a shiver, trying not to dwell on the fact that the appearance of the doctor always signaled catastrophe in the next act. Lauren went to one of the shelves and pulled out a small book. Even at a glimpse, I recognized it as mine. A dark stain patterned the cover from the time it had got wet during a storm in Tarbin. I fumbled with the strings of my purse, surprised to see my hands trembling slightly.
It was 2 silver pennies, I believe?
Lauren nodded.
Can I offer you anything in addition to that? If you hadn't bought it for me, I would have lost it forever. Not to mention the fact that your purchase helped me gain admittance in the first place.
2 silver pennies will be sufficient.
I lay the coins on his desk. They clattered slightly as I set them down, testament to my shaking hands. Lauren held out the book and I wiped my sweaty hands on my shirt before taking it. I opened it to Ben's inscription and smiled.
Thank you for taking care of it, Master Lauren. It is precious to me.
The care of one more book is little trouble,
Lauren said as he returned to his seat. I waited to see if he might continue. He didn't. My voice snagged in my throat. I swallowed to clear it.
I also wanted to say that I was sorry for...
I stalled at the thought of actually mentioning Open Flame in the archives.
For what I did before,
I finished lamely.
I accept your apology, Quoth.
Lauren looked back down at the book he had been reading when I had come in.
Good morning.
I swallowed, again, against the dryness in my mouth.
I was also wondering when I might hope to regain admittance to the archives.
Lauren looked up at me.
You were caught with live fire among my books,
he said, emotion touching the edges of his voice like a hint of red sunset against the slate-gray clouds. All of my carefully planned persuasion flew out of my head.
Master Lauren, I pleaded. I'd been whipped that day and wasn't at my wit's best. Ambrose...
Lauren raised his long-fingered hand from the desk, his palm facing out towards me. The careful gesture cut me off more quickly than a slap across the face. His face was expressionless as a blank page.
Who am I to believe? A Relar of 3 years or an Elier of 2 months? A scriv in my employ? Or an unfamiliar student found guilty of reckless use of sympathy.
I managed to regain a little of my composure.
I understand your decision, Master Lauren, but is there anything I might do to earn readmittance?
I asked, unable to keep my voice entirely free of desperation.
Honestly, I would rather be whipped again than spend another term banned. I would give you all the money in my pocket, though it isn't much. I'd work long hours as a scriv, without pay, for the privilege of proving myself to you. I know you're short-staffed during exams.
Lauren looked at me, his placid eyes almost curious. I couldn't help but feel that my plea had affected him.
All that?
All that, I said earnestly, hope billowing wildly through my chest.
All that and any other penance you desire.
I require but one thing to rescind my ban,
Lauren said. I fought to keep a manic grin off my face.
Anything?
Demonstrate the patience and prudence which you have heretofore been lacking,
Lauren said flatly, then looked down at the book that lay open on his desk.
Good morning.
The next day... One of Jameson's errand boys woke me out of a sound sleep in my vast bed at the Horse and Four. He informed me that I was due on the horns at 15:45 before noon. I was being charged with conduct unbecoming a member of the Arcanum. Ambrose had finally caught wind of my song. I spent the next several hours feeling vaguely sick to my stomach. This was exactly what I'd hoped to avoid. An opportunity for both Ambrose and Hemet to settle scores with me. Worse still, this was bound to lower Lauren's opinion of me even further, no matter what the outcome. I arrived in the Master's Hall early and was relieved to find the atmosphere much more relaxed than when I'd gone on the horns for malfeasance against Hemet. Arwill and Elksa Dahl smiled at me. Kilvin nodded. I was relieved that I had friends among the Masters to balance out the enemies I'd made.
All right,
the Chancellor said briskly.
We've got 10 minutes before we start admissions. I don't feel like getting behind schedule, so I'm going to move this right along.
He looked around at the rest of the Masters and saw only nods.
Relar Ambrose, make your case. Keep it under a minute.
You have a copy of the song right there,
Ambrose said hotly.
It's slanderous. It defames my good name. It's a shameful way for a member of the Arcanum to behave.
He swallowed, his jaw clenching.
That's all.
The Chancellor turned to me.
Anything to say in your defence?
It was in poor taste, Chancellor, but I didn't expect it to get around. I only sang it on one occasion, in fact.
Fair enough.
The Chancellor looked down at the paper in front of him. He cleared his throat.
Raylar Ambrose, are you a donkey?
Ambrose went stiff.
No, sir,
he said.
Are you possessed of...
He cleared his throat and read directly off the page.
A pizzle bound to fizzle?
A few of the masters struggled to control smiles. Elodine grinned openly. Ambrose flushed.
No, sir.
Then I'm afraid I don't see the problem,
the Chancellor said curtly, letting the paper settle to the table.
I move the charge of conduct unbecoming be replaced with undignified mischief.
Second that,
Kilvin said.
All in favour?
All hands went up, except for Hemes and Brandiers.
Motion passed. Discipline will be set at a formal letter of apology attended to.
For God's sake, Arthur!
Hemme broke in.
At least make it a public letter.
The Chancellor glared at Hemme, then shrugged.
Formal letter of apology, posted publicly before the full term. All in favour?
All hands were raised.
Motion passed.
The Chancellor leaned forward onto his elbows and looked down at Ambrose.
Raylar Ambrose, in the future you will refrain from wasting our time with spurious charges.
I could feel the anger radiating off Ambrose. It was like standing near a fire.
Yes, sir.
Before I could feel smug, the Chancellor turned to me.
And you, Elia Quoth, will comport yourself with more decorum in the future.
His stern words were somewhat spoiled by the fact that Elodine had begun cheerfully humming the melody to Jackass, Jackass, next to him. I lowered my eyes and did my best to fight down a smile. Yes, sir.
Dismissed.
Ambrose turned on his heel and stormed off, but before he made it through the door, Elodine burst out singing.
He's a well-bred ass, you can see it in the stride, and for a copper penny he will let you take a ride.
The thought of writing a public apology was galling to me. But as they say, the best revenge is living well, so I decided to ignore Ambrose and enjoy my new luxurious lifestyle at the Horse and Four. But I only managed 2 days of revenge. On the third day, the Horse and Four had a new owner. Short, jolly Caverin was replaced with a tall, thin man who informed me that my services were no longer required. I was told to vacate my rooms before nightfall. It was irritating, but I knew of at least 4 or 5 inns of a similar quality on this side of the river that would jump at the chance to employ a musician with his talent pipes. But the innkeeper at Hollybush refused to speak with me. The White Hart and Queen's Crown were content with their current musicians. At the Golden Pony, I waited for over an hour before I realized I was being politely ignored. By the time I was turned away by the Royal Oak, I was fuming. It was Ambrose. I didn't know how he'd done it, but I knew it was him. Bribes, perhaps, or a rumour that any inn employing a certain red-haired musician would be losing the business of a large number of wealthy, noble customers. So I began working my way through the rest of the inns this side of the river. I'd already been turned away by the upper-class ones, but there were many respectable places left. Over the next several hours I tried the Shepherd's Rest, the Boar's Head, Dog in the Wall, Staves Inn, and the Tabard. Ambrose had been very thorough. None of them was interested. It was early evening by the time I came to Anchors, and by that time, The only thing keeping me going was pure black temper. I was determined to try every single inn on this side of the river before I resorted to paying for a bunk and a meal chit again. When I came to the inn, Anchor himself was up on a ladder, nailing a long piece of cedar siding back into place. He looked down at me as I came to stand near the foot of the ladder.
"So you're the one,"
he said.
"Beg your pardon?"
I said, puzzled.
"Fellow stopped by and told me that hiring a young red-haired fellow would make for a great pile of unpleasantness."
He nodded at my loot.
"You must be him."
"Well then," I said, adjusting the shoulder strap of my loot case, "I won't waste your time."
"You aren't wasting it yet,"
he said as he climbed down the ladder, wiping his hands on his shirt.
"The place could use some music."
I gave him a searching look.
"Aren't you worried?"
He spat.
"Them little gadflies think they can buy the sun out of the sky, don't they?"
"This particular one could probably afford it," I said grimly. "And the moon, too, if he wanted the match set to use as bookends." He snorted derisively.
"Ha! He can't do a damn thing to me. I don't cater to his sort of folk, so he can't scare off my business. And I own this place my own self, so he can't buy it and fire me off like he did to poor old Kevrin."
"Someone bought the horse and four." Anchor gave me a speculative look.
"You didn't know?"
I shook my head slowly, taking a moment to digest this piece of information. Ambrose had bought the horse and four just to spite me out of a job. No, he was too clever for that. He'd probably loaned the money to a friend and passed it off as a business venture. How much had it cost? 1,000 talents? 5,000? I couldn't even guess how much an inn like the Horse and Four was worth. What was even more disturbing was how quickly he had managed it. It put things in sharp perspective for me. I'd known Ambrose was rich, but honestly, everyone was rich compared to me. I'd never bothered thinking about how wealthy he was or how he could use it against me. I was getting a lesson in the sort of influence a wealthy baron's firstborn son could bring to bear. For the first time, I was glad for the university's strict code of conduct. If Ambrose was willing to go to these lengths, I could only imagine what drastic measures he would take if he didn't need to maintain a semblance of civility. I was jolted out of my reverie by a young woman leaning out of the front door of the inn.
"Damn you, Anchor!"
she shouted.
"I'm not going to pull and carry while you stand out here scratching your ass. Get in there!"
Anchor muttered something under his breath as he picked up the ladder and he stowed it around the corner in the alleyway.
"What'd you do to this fellow anyway, Tuppish Mum?"
"Wrote a song about him, actually." As Anchor opened the door of the inn, a gentle welter of conversation poured out into the street.
"I'd be curious to hear a song like that," he grinned. "Why don't you come give it a play?"
"If you're sure," I said, not quite believing my luck. "There's bound to be trouble."
Trouble?
He chuckled.
"What does a boy like you know about trouble? I was in trouble afore you were born. I've been in trouble you don't even got words for."
He turned to face me, still standing in the doorway.
"It's been a while since we've had music on here regular. Can't say as I like to go without. A proper tavern has music."
I smiled.
"I have to agree with you there. Truth is, I'd have you in just to twist that rich tit's nose," Anchor said. "But if you can play worth half of them."
He pushed the door open farther, making it an invitation. I could smell sawdust and honest sweat and baking bread. By the end of the night, it was all arranged. In exchange for playing 4 nights a span, I earned a tiny room on the 3rd floor and the assurance that if I was around at mealtimes, I would be welcome to a bit of whatever was cooking in the pot. Admittedly, Anchor was getting the services of a talented musician for a bargain price, but it was a deal I was happy to make. Anything was better than going back to Muse and the silent scorn of my bunkmates. The ceiling of my tiny room slanted downward in 2 corners, making it seem even smaller than it really was. It would have been cluttered if there had been more than the few sticks of furniture, a small desk with a wooden chair, and a single shelf above it. The bed was flat and narrow as any bunk in the mews. I set my slightly battered copy of Rhetoric and Logic on the shelf over the desk. My loot case leaned comfortably in the corner. Through the window, I could see the lights of the university, unblinking in the cool autumn air. I was home. Looking back, I count myself lucky that I ended up in Anchors. True, the crowds were not as wealthy as those at the Horse and Four, but they appreciated me in a way the nobles never had. And while my suite of rooms at the Horse and Four had been luxurious, my tiny room at Anchors was comfortable. Think in terms of shoes. You don't want the biggest you can find, you want the pair that fits. In time, that tiny room at Anchors came to be more of a home to me than anywhere else in the world. But at that particular moment, I was furious at what Ambrose had cost me. So when I sat down to write my public letter of apology, it dripped with venomous sincerity. It was a work of art. I beat my breast with remorse. I wailed and gnashed my teeth over the fact that I had maligned a fellow student. I also included a full copy of the lyrics, along with two new verses and full musical notation. I then apologized in excruciating detail about every vulgar, petty innuendo included in the song. I then spent four precious jots of my own money on paper and ink, and called in the favor Jaxim owed me for trading him my late admission slot. He had a friend that worked in a print shop, and with his help, we printed over 100 copies of the letter. Then, the night before fall term began, Will, Sim, and I posted them on every flat surface we could find on both sides of the river. We used a lovely alchemical adhesive Simon had cooked up for the occasion. The stuff went on like paint, then dried clear as glass and hard as steel. If anyone wanted to remove the posts, they'd need a hammer and chisel. In hindsight, it was as foolish as taunting an angry bull. And if I had to guess, I'd say this particular piece of insolence was the main reason Ambrose eventually tried to kill me. Chapter 62 Leaves. Under pointed advice from several sources, I limited myself to three fields of study in the upcoming term. I continued advanced sympathy with Elxadal, held a shift in the Medica, and continued my apprenticeship under Manet. My time was pleasantly full, but not overburdened as it had been last term. I studied my artificing more doggedly than anything else. Since my search for a patron had come to a dead end, I knew my best chance for self-sufficiency lay in becoming an artificer. Currently, I worked for Kilvin and was given relatively menial jobs at relatively low pay. Once I finished my apprenticeship, that would improve. Better still, I would be able to pursue my own projects, then sell them on commission for a profit. If I was able to keep ahead of my debt to Devi. If I could somehow continue to muster enough money for tuition. If I could finish my apprenticeship under Manet without getting myself killed or crippled by the dangerous work that was done in the fishery every day. 40 or 50 of us gathered in the workshop waiting to see the new arrival. Some sat on the stone work tables to get a good view, while a dozen or so students gathered on the iron catwalks in the rafters among Kilvin's hanging lamps. I saw Manet up there. He was hard to miss, 3 times older than any of the other students with his wild hair and grizzled beard. I headed up the stairs and made my way to his side. He smiled and clapped me on the shoulder.
"What are you doing here?" I asked. "I thought this was just for the Greenwood, who haven't seen this stuff before."
"I thought I'd play the dutiful mentor today," he shrugged. "Besides, this particular display is worth watching, if only for the expressions on everyone's faces."
Sitting atop one of the shop's heavy work tables was a massive cylindrical container, about 4 feet high and 2 feet across. The edges were sealed without any bulky welds, and the metal had a dull, burnished look that made me guess it was more than simple steel. I let my gaze wander the room, and was surprised to see Fela standing in the crowd, waiting for the demonstration to begin along with the rest of the students.
I didn't know Fela worked here,
I said to Manet. Manet nodded.
Oh, sure. What, 2 terms now?
I'm surprised I haven't noticed,
I mused, as I watched her talking to one of the other women in the crowd.
So am I, Manet said with a low, knowing chuckle. Well, she's not here very often. She sculpts and works with cut tile and glass. She's here for the equipment, not the sigildry.
The belling tower struck the hour outside, and Kilvin looked around, marking the faces of everyone there. I didn't doubt for a moment that he took note of exactly who was missing.
For several span, we will have this in the shop, he said simply,
gesturing to the metal container that stood nearby.
Nearly 10 gallons of a volatile transporting agent. Regim ignaul neratum.
He's the only one that calls it that, Manet said softly. It's bone tar.
Bone tar? He nodded.
It's caustic. Spill it on your arm and it'll eat through to the bone in about 10 seconds.
While everyone watched, Kilvin donned a thick leather glove and decanted about 1 ounce of dark liquid from the metal canister into a glass vial.
It is important to chill the vial prior to decanting, as the agent boils at room temperature.
He quickly sealed off the vial and held it up for everyone to see.
The pressure cap is also essential, as the liquid is extremely volatile. As a gas, it exhibits surface tension and viscosity, like mercury. It is heavier than air and does not dissipate. It coheres to itself.
With no further preamble, Kilvin tossed the vial into a nearby firewell, and there was the sharp, clear sound of breaking glass. From this height, I could see the firewell must have been cleaned out specially for this occasion. It was empty, just a shallow, circular pit of bare stone.
It's a shame he's not more of a showman,
Manet said softly to me.
Elxadar could do this with a little more flair.
The room was filled with a sharp crackling and hissing as the dark liquid warmed itself against the stone of the firewell and began to boil. From my high vantage, I could see a thick, oily smoke slowly filling the bottom of the well. It didn't behave like fog or smoke at all. Its edges didn't diffuse. It pooled and hung together like a tiny, dark cloud. Manet tapped me on the shoulder, and I looked at him just in time to avoid being blinded by the initial burst of flame as the cloud caught fire. There were dismayed noises from all around, and I guessed most of the others had been caught unaware. Manet grinned at me and gave a knowing wink.
Thanks,
I said, and turned back to watch. Jagged flames danced across the surface of the fog, colored a bright sodium red. The additional heat made the dark fog boil faster, and it swelled until the flames were licking towards the top of the waist-high lip of the firewell. Even from where I stood on the catwalk, I could feel a gentle heat on my face.
What the hell do you call that?
I asked him quietly.
Fire fog?
We could, he responded. Kilvin would probably call it an atmospherically activated incendiary action.
The fire flickered and died all at once, leaving the room filled with the acrid smell of hot stone.
In addition to being highly corrosive, Kilvin said, in its gaseous state, the reagent is flammable. Once it warms sufficiently, it will burn on contact with air. The heat that this produces can cause a cascading exothermic reaction.
Cascading huge goddamn fire, Manet said.
You're better than a chorus,
I said softly, trying to keep a straight face. Kilvin gestured.
This container is designed to keep the agent cold and under pressure. Be mindful while it remains in the workshop. Avoid excessive heat in its immediate vicinity.
With that, Kilvin turned and headed back into his office.
That's it?
I asked. Manet shrugged.
What else needs to be said? Kilvin doesn't let anyone work here unless they're careful, and now everyone knows what to be careful of.
Why is it even here?
I asked.
What's it good for?
Scares the hell out of the first-timers, he grinned.
Anything more practical than that?
Fear is plenty practical, he said. But you can use it to make a different type of emitter for sympathy lamps. You get a bluish light instead of the ordinary red. A little easier on the eyes.